Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Robbie Weissman, a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust. In recognition of Holocaust Remembrance Day, the Durham Museum has partnered with the Jewish Federation and the Institute for Holocaust Education for this special presentation. Mr. Weissman was born in Skarżysko, Poland. He managed to survive the Holocaust in various concentration camps as a slave laborer in ammunition factories. He was liberated by the American Army from Buchenwald on April 11, 1945. Mr. Weissman's talk followed a special screening of the 2002 Canadian television documentary, The Boys of Buchenwald, directed by Audrey Mailer, which chronicled the return after nearly 60 years of three child survivors of the Buchenwald concentration camp, including Mr. Weissman, Joseph Schwarzberg, and well-deserved Nobel Peace Prize recipient Elie Wiesel to the homes in France which took them in after the war. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, May 4, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Mr. Robbie Weissman was born in Poland in 1931, and when the Holocaust began, his entire family was murdered except for one sister, Leah Fox. He managed to survive the Holocaust in various concentration camps as a slave laborer in ammunition factories. The American Army liberated him from Buchenwald on April 11, 1945. He then spent the next 4 years in France, where he caught up his schooling and rehabilitation. In an attempt to distance himself from the pain of the Holocaust, Mr. Weissman left Europe for a new life, and in December of 1949 arrived in Calgary and then settled in Saskatoon in 1959 with his new bride, Gloria Lyons. Robbie, as an accountant, entered the retail clothing business, where he owned two children's wear shops and a teen store. He always found time to participate in community activities. He was involved in every facet of the Jewish community. He has also been very involved in sharing and providing these types of stories and this type of education. The Boys of Buchenwald, From Darkness into Light, shares the story of three Jewish boys who knew the horrors of Buchenwald concentration camp. As the trains left Germany full of orphan children, the boys created a fraternity based on need and banded together against a world they did not trust. Their new life began in a children's home in France, and two of the former staff members recall the boys' struggle to adjust, and many adults regarded them as damaged beyond repair. But slowly, the boys began to find good in people, and almost 60 years after their liberation from Buchenwald, the boys met again, touring the homes in France and attending a reunion in Jerusalem. The bonds of friendship that helped them rebuild their lives after the Holocaust are still strong. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great honor, great admiration, and great joy that I introduce to you Mr. Robbie Weissman.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I haven't seen this film for a while, and it really brings back memories. I will be answering some questions in a short while, but first I want to give you a glimpse of how I survived the Holocaust.
April 11, 1945, we were liberated by the American Army. I used that day, 11th, as my birthday. I was reborn that day. When the American soldiers came in and they took a look at us, they were surprised to find teenagers like myself. And they began to wonder, why are they here? What did they do? A few days later, other men came to solve the puzzle. They began to take our names, where we came from, what were our nationalities. And I remember when my turn came and they asked me my name, I blurted out 117-098. It was my number. We lived in that camp where Dad was a constant companion. Our main purpose, and I remember my own life in that camp, my incentive was to survive no matter what, because I wanted to go home. I wanted to be reunited with my family. Now, how did I get to Buchenwald? I want to take a few moments and give you a glimpse. I'm going to share some memories with you, and some are good ones, that of home that I remember. But some are horrible. And when I share these horrible memories with you, it is not to sadden you. It is to strengthen you. And it's not to really make you feel bad. I don't want to sadden you. Again, I want to empower you. And what do I mean by that? In Vancouver, where I live, I witnessed what happened to some young kids, particularly this one young lady, who was bullied in school. And she took her life. When somebody tells an ethnic joke, will you have the courage to say very simply, "Hey, that's not funny"? If you do this at school, you will have really paid me back for sharing my memories with you, those particularly those painful ones. Let me take you back to my hometown in Skarżysko. There were six of us. We were five brothers and one sister. I was the baby. And when I think back, I couldn't do any wrong. Everything that I did that I wouldn't allow with my own kids, I was forgiven. I was surrounded by love. And it was wonderful. I took advantage of it. Another happy incident, when I speak to you about my brother Chaim, he was the oldest, I think of James Bond. He was my James Bond. And when he came home from his army, he was an officer with his beautiful uniform. There was a parade of girls coming to our house to borrow some sugar or any kind of excuse so that they would notice, or he would notice, and some of them. One particular girl, I remember, her name was Golda. She had black hair and she had a ringlet on her forehead, like a question mark turned upside down. At that time, I was 8 years old, and I noticed Golda, and I had a crush on Golda. And my brother had the same taste as I did, and he noticed her as well. And when they began to go together to date, I had a problem. And when they became engaged, I finally decided to give her up. But wait, I was compensated for it. They were married, and their firstborn was a little boy, Nathan. And I was a proud uncle. And that's where the sad part comes in, because Golda, after later on, when we were ghettoized, and she could have quite easily gone to work in the munitions factory and might have survived. But she wouldn't leave her little boy Nathan behind, and they were packed into cattle trains, and she landed up in Treblinka. a gas chamber. I often wonder how many other mothers did the same. Another happy memory I have is when Friday night, after welcoming the Sabbath, we didn't have television and we didn't miss it. My father would read stories by the author Sholem Aleichem. That's the same man who wrote Fiddler on the Roof. How many of you saw Fiddler on the Roof? Yes, quite a few. Those of you that haven't, get the video because it's beautiful, a beautiful musical, and it depicts life the way I remember it. A little boy named Shmulek would come with his family to listen to my father. He was my friend. We went to kindergarten together. We started grade 1 and 2. And of course, when he came, we had our own agenda, and we weren't listening. And my father told us to stop, to be quiet. And we did for a short while, and then we started all over again. Finally, he had enough of it, and he grabbed me by the ear, and we went into the next room. And when he was finished with me, I made sure that Shmulek and I listened. And I'm grateful because I remembered those wonderful stories. So this kind of life that I just gave you a glimpse of ended abruptly in September of 1939 when the Nazis invaded Poland. The first soldiers that I saw were 18, 19-year-olds from the Wehrmacht. They came into our house and asked for refreshments. And my mother invited them in, offered them some tea and homemade wine that my mother made out of cherries. And I remember how they drank it separately, and my mom showed them how to mix it together. And they asked for seconds. Yiddish and German is very similar, and we were able to communicate with these young men. As a matter of fact, to this day, I don't have the recipe of that wine. And when I have a cold, I put scotch in my tea. Now, to all these young people here, I don't suggest that you try this because I don't want your parents to seek me out and be angry at me. But I see that you're old enough, so try it. But I promise you one thing, you'll get rid of the cold, but you'll wake up with a heck of a hangover. When these soldiers left our house, I remember there was a parade of neighbors coming into our house wanting to know, hey, we saw these soldiers in your house. What happened? And we reassured them that they were really nice kids. And we enjoyed the visit. A week later, I noticed other soldiers. They were more mature, and they had uniforms that were different. They were black with the SS insignia. And work roundups began. And one man was running away. And I remember he was asked to stop and didn't, and he was shot. And that was the first time I saw somebody being shot right in front of me. And believe me, it's not the same as when you go to movies and you see this happening. When I ran home to tell my parents of what I had witnessed, that was the end of my roaming around. They wouldn't allow me to go out to the house. Shortly after, my father came home and told the rest of the family that he saw this advice that anybody coming to register to work in the munitions factory would get a work permit and wouldn't worry about these work roundups. And so everyone in my family registered except myself. I was yet too young to go. And my mom, who wanted to be home so that when they came home at night, they would have a hot meal. I overheard my parents in sort of in a hushed voice so I wouldn't hear What are we going to do with the baby? They were worried, referring to me. And again, my father came home one day, very excited. He found a way of saving my life. I packed a few of my belongings and he took me out to a farm, gave the farmer some money and some jewelry from my keep, told me to listen, do what I'm told to do, and that he'd be back to get me when the war is over. I asked, how long is that going to be? Not very long, he told me. I had chores to do in the morning, and in the afternoon, I fed the chickens and do all sorts of things. But in the afternoon, they introduced me to a herd of cows that I was supposed to look after. And I have to tell you that the cows and I didn't get along. I don't have good memories. And so after several weeks, I was lonely for my mom. I left the cows behind and I came home. And when my father saw me, I'd never seen him so angry. He gave me a spanking. He thought that he had a solution, and I blew it. And you know, even that spanking I cherished because it was really done out of love. The war is progressing, we are ghettoized, and there are rumors that they're going to liquidate the ghetto. My brother, my James Bond, one morning came into the ghetto. He had access to a van. He was doing all sorts of work for the munitions factory. And my mom woke me up, telling me that I was going with my brother. And I asked, where am I going? And she says, you're going to a farm. And I immediately visualized cows. And I said to my mom, I'm not interested. I want to stay with you. And she convinced me to go with my brother. It's only going to be for a short while. Go with your brother. And you know, I sometimes wonder how my mom had the foresight to send me out. Did she know or had this sense? Because mothers usually, particularly the youngest, they like to keep with them. Had she done this, I wouldn't be here. My brother took me to a farm, but it was a deserted one, left me on top of a hayloft, told me to be quiet, I'll be back for you shortly. I thought, a couple hours. Nightfall. I disobeyed. I descended in the middle of the night looking for food. I was hungry. Finally, when he did show up, he was very agitated, very worried. And I remember saying, Hamu, what's wrong? He said, shut up, just follow me. I says, where's mom, where's dad, where's everyone? Just follow me. He took me into the ammunition factory, introduced me to a foreman, and I received my first job, which was to put the initial FES on anti-aircraft shells, 8 inches high, about 3 inches in diameter. And I, from 7 in the morning to 7 at night, my quota was 3,200. I wasn't used to it. My fingers began to bleed. And I bandaged them with some rags. It's amazing when you know that your life depends on it, how quick one adapts. Afterward, we would go to the barracks to sleep. The barracks, there's a picture of the barracks. Anybody that wants to have a closer look can come later and have a look. There were rows
four rows of bunks with straw in it. We slept in our clothes. They were not unusual to see rats running around. Typhoid fever broke out, and people were dying every day. And I remember seeing three men. One with a two-wheel buggy would just come into the barracks, and two other men would look in the bunks to see who had died at night. And they would just pull them out and throw them like a sack of potatoes. This is how life was looked on in the camp. One day, my brother next to me, Abram, worked adjacent to me, and we used to go to work together and go home together. He used to put cardboard in my shoes to make me appear taller because there were no youngsters of my age. As we walked in rows of four, he made sure that I was inside so a guard wouldn't notice me. I was safe at work, but not going to work and going to the barracks. One day, as we were lining up in the morning to go to work, I noticed my brother Abram sort of stumbled and his eyes were glassy. And there was one of the guys that was close to us, happened to be a doctor, and I asked him, I said, Shlomo, what is wrong with my brother? And I had heard the dreaded voice saying, he has typhoid. There was an infirmary close by with nurses in white uniforms, very inviting. But I knew that not to take my brother there because I saw other sick people going to the infirmary, into the front door, taken to the back where a guard with a rifle would shoot the sick person. So I did the best thing that I could at the time. I took my brother back into the barracks, covered him with straw, in the hope that my father, who worked night shift, would find him, and indeed he did, and managed to nurse him back to health. Not completely. So that morning, I was anxious to get my brother to work because at least for 12 hours, you needn't have worried, and it was a chance for him to recoup. But the guard noticed that his health wasn't perfect, and he pulled him out and others like him, and they led him to a waiting truck. And I followed my brother, and this man, this doctor, grabbed me back. He says, you don't want to go with your brother. I says, yes, I do want to go with my brother. I wanted at least to go and give him a hug. I never said to my brother, I love you. And besides, I wanted to be with him. And my brother looked back and he motioned me to stay away because he knew that where he is going is not safe. When they had enough people in the truck, it began to move out of the compound to, there was a wooded area not far away, and I lost sight of the truck. And I stood there. And then all of a sudden I heard a sort of a muffled sound of machine gun fire. And then shortly after, the truck was coming back, and I remember thinking, my brother Abram is on the truck. He's coming back. But the truck was empty. I don't know how to come to terms with that. He was a marvelous, wonderful human being. Not only was he instrumental in showing me the art of survival, but he was so compassionate. He would help anybody that needed help. Why did they have to murder him? What was his crime? An accident of birth. He was born Jewish. And if you were a Jew during those times, you were condemned to die.
I saw my father only on Sunday, and I used to look forward to it. And so that first Sunday after this episode, I looked at my dad, and I didn't recognize him. His black hair suddenly turned white. And I said to him, "Dad, what's wrong?" And he wouldn't answer me. And I saw a tear going down his cheek. And I became angry at him. I wanted and needed my father. I needed his strength. I needed him to say, "Don't worry, we're going to make it." He was that kind of a person, always very optimistic to the neighbors, to the family. But he couldn't. And now I have to admit to you, when I go into the synagogue to pray, my first prayer is to ask forgiveness of my father. I did not appreciate the pain that he had to suffer to see. I learned many years later that he also witnessed one of my other brothers that was killed. We used to wave to one another as we were going to work and back to the barracks. And on Monday I saw my father and we waved. On Tuesday we waved to one another. And Wednesday, three times. And on Thursday, I didn't see him. And I asked around, "Anybody see my dad?" And no one was able to tell me anything. And to this day, I wonder, I speculate, how did my father die? Did he run up to the electric wires? I saw people do this, and I could never understand till many years later why they ended their life. They would touch the electric wires, and they shook for a short while, and they would die. Or maybe he didn't walk fast enough and fell behind, another way of inviting a bullet. Or maybe he lay down in the bunks that I described earlier and died of a broken heart. He who believed in humanity, he believed in German society. He used to brag to our neighbors to reassure them that Germany is in the forefront of civilization. They produced Bach, Beethoven, Schule. And I remember all these names. How disappointed he must have been. 1943-44, some of the adults, one of them particularly said to me, "Hang on, kids, we're going to make it." The Russians were advancing on the Eastern Front, and it was only days before we were going to be liberated. But it wasn't to be. We were packed into cattle trains. I even have a photo of it. It's just an exact replica. And I can tell you exactly where I was crunched down. There wasn't even room for crunching down. And we spent days without food or water. And it was a blessing in disguise because after a while, you sort of become numb. But when we now and then would... I remember the cars would stop and a voice outside would say, "Do you have any dead bodies?" And we always did. So somebody on the outside would open the two doors and we would just push the people that had died. So when we arrived at destination, we had lots of room. And I remember, as described in that film, when they opened the door and I saw these inmates in striped uniforms that looked like they came from another planet. They didn't look human. And that's when I remember thinking that I'll never make it. So I want to stop there and show you a little clip. This was a documentary made because the soldiers that came and liberated us, there were a few that were black. And I had never seen a black person before. And I've been tormented by white people. And when I saw these black people, I was sure that they were angels. And so I ran up to touch one of them, because I wanted to be sure that I'm not dreaming. This is real. And I was reunited many, many years later, and you'll see it in the video.
And I remember my father saying, okay, so they'll kill 10, 20, 100, 200. I mean, how many people can he kill?
When Nazi stormtroopers put Robbie Wiseman in a concentration camp called Buchenwald, he was only 13 years old.
And so I walked into that camp, and when I got through those gates, I saw the living dead.
When Leon Bass marched in to liberate Buchenwald, he was the first black man Robbie Wiseman had ever seen, but a face he would never forget.
I touched him 40 years ago, and 40 years later, he's liberating me all over again. And he's touching me and touching others.
How are you?
So good to see you.
Fine.
Fine. How are you?
Good.
Robbie Wiseman has flown from his home in Vancouver to Philadelphia for a reunion with Leon Bass, one of the American soldiers who set him free. It is a journey back through 40 years of horrid memories. As the Nazi blitzkrieg roared across Europe, more than 6 million Jews were forced into the streets, packed onto cattle cars, and hauled away to concentration camps. Those strong enough to work stayed alive as slave labor. Those too old, too weak, or too demoralized were killed in Hitler's extermination campaign. Robbie Wiseman lost his mother, his father, and four brothers.
Maybe it's a good thing that I didn't have a chance to say goodbye to my mother, because I loved her very dearly. And to say goodbye and to have something final like this, I don't think I would have been able to take it.
In the lost childhood of Robbie Wiseman, even a bar of soap became a thing of terror.
I remember going into one of those huge shower rooms with nothing but a piece of soap that they hand you as you walk in. And there we were, waiting until they got enough people in. And we were in this place with the soap, looking up at the shower heads and wondering, is the water going to come out? Or is this lethal gas going to come out? An eternity. By the time you see the water, and you feel it, you know, and you see this, the steam. Yeah. Gonna make it another day.
How could anybody so young endure what you went through? How could anybody as young as you were be that strong?
Stupidity. The will to live. I don't know. I just wanted to live. And I was lucky.
Hold it, fellas. Ladies, gentlemen, coolest.
Today, Leon Bass teaches history to a generation that can scarcely comprehend the Holocaust. But to hear him tell a very personal soldier story is to be convinced. 40 years ago, just out of high school himself, he followed General Patton deep into the heart of Germany, completely unprepared for what he was about to see.
We pushed him back through Luxembourg, through Belgium, all the way up to the Rhine River. And I remember the Rhine River because some of the fellows found a pink champagne factory. And they took on a real blast. I never forget that. We didn't build any bridges that night. And they did. I remember the place called Mainz, right on the Rhine, across from Frankfurt. But we finally did get across the Rhine and into Germany. And then we went on up through Cologne and Dusseldorf and Eisenach and Nuremberg. And I remember all those names. They were only in the history books before. But now they were real to me. And we were winning the war at that point.
We heard rumors that the Americans were advancing, and we had the feeling that it's only hours away. All kinds of thoughts go through your mind when you almost taste the victory. Suddenly, silence, nothing. After a short while, I remember pulling myself up on the windowsill and looking up. Our barracks was not far from the main gate of Buchenwald. I kept looking at it, and I could see movement, and I could see soldiers. And the uniforms were different, and I knew that must be somebody other than Germans. And I could see jeeps coming through, and then more people start getting up, and that's when everything, all chaos, all hell broke loose. People running everywhere. I saw these two soldiers, and I shook my head, and I said, what kind of people are these? They're black. I didn't know that there's such a thing. You know, I thought everybody was white. So a black man to me was a very strange phenomenon. I touched him. I touched this Scott, and I touched Leon.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I couldn't get a handle on it. I didn't know. I was just about 20 years of age at that time. And I had never seen anything like this. I had seen death, but I hadn't seen anything like this. Some of them were stumbling about, trying to remain on their feet. Others were holding on to each other to maintain stability. Some were covered with sores due to malnutrition. They were emaciated. Their faces were just thin. They were skin and bone. The eyes went deep in their heads. I saw people, human beings who had been so brutalized, so maltreated, starved, tortured, not given enough medical attention. They were there, and I looked at them. I just had to stop in my tracks and look. And you keep in mind that Buchenwald was a small camp in comparison to some of the others like Auschwitz, Dachau, and so many others that were spread all over Eastern Europe.
We didn't know the enormity of the Holocaust. We didn't know that so many million had died. I didn't know that I had lost. I knew that I lost my brother next to me, but I still expected to find three more brothers.
So I'll stop now, and because there's so many things that I would like to share with you, but I'll answer your questions.
I wonder if, you know, there's a lot of Holocaust survivors who refuse to talk because the pain is too great. You have chosen to speak. Is the reason because you had connection with the boys and that's what emotionally brought you through? Or why did you choose to speak?
It is very difficult to speak, and I didn't for about 30 years. It was too painful. In Eckville, Alberta, in Canada, there was a high school teacher by the name of Kiekstra who was teaching his students that the Holocaust was a myth. It didn't happen. And I remember one night, one of the adults said to me, "Hey, kid, when you survive and you are liberated, be sure that you tell the world what you have witnessed." Because they were worried that here we are, dying terribly, and nobody will ever know about it. And I remember another man, the lights were out, so I just heard their voices. Another man said, "Well, leave the kid alone. None of us are going to make it." This guy was really optimistic. And so he made me promise, this other man. He says, "Promise me here so that everybody can hear that you will talk about it." But I didn't for all these years because it was too painful. I did not share all this pain. I just put it aside. At first, in France, you saw there was one of the caregivers was Professor Manfred Reingwitz from the Sorbonne. And I remember we were really very nasty because he was trying to make us, you know, act and do as normal teenagers. And we just didn't know how. And as you heard in that movie, you know, we knew better than anybody else. And I can't repeat the words that I used when he was lecturing me. I told him where to go. You figure it out. But one day, after one of his lectures, he wouldn't give up. He said to me, after this, as he was walking away, he says, "One more thing, Romek," that was my name. "What do you think your parents would want for you if they were standing where I am standing?" And that resonated with me as well as all the others. Yes, we survived. We have a duty and obligation to our parents, to our loved ones. When I speak to young students, I do it on behalf of the 1.5 million Jewish children that were brutally murdered. I speak on behalf of my little nephew Nathan, and I wonder what he might have become. I speak about my friend who came to listen with me when my father read from Shalom Aleichem. I'm supposed to answer questions, and now I find myself making more speeches.
Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
This is for one of my sons who asked me to ask you. Do you still have your number on your arm? Do you have it tattooed still on your arm?
No. I only those people that were in Auschwitz and were selected to work would receive a number. My number was on my lapel in Buchenwald. It wasn't tattooed on my arm.
Sir, what inner resources keep you going?
What inner
resources inside of you keep you going and growing and thriving?
Again, I feel a duty and obligation, and I use my experiences of the Holocaust. It gives all of us an opportunity to really reflect on the moral responsibilities we have as individuals, as well as societies and governments. When I speak to young students, to high school students particularly, I try to inoculate them against hatred and discrimination. I work with a group of university students for Darfur. The Holocaust was supposed to have been the one thing in our world to teach the world how to get along with one another. And yet, after all these years, the phrase that these students use is "never again." I, as a Holocaust survivor, want to put meaning to "never again." And I know how children in Darfur feel. I was in their shoes, being threatened with my life and hungry constantly. I wear a pin, and I'm very proud of it, Darfur. So we have this duty and obligation, and as long when I speak to you, it is painful, but I honor the memory of those that are not here with us. And we strive to make this a better world.
How has your experiences affected your faith and your relationship with Yahweh?
What a wonderful question. I came from an Orthodox family, and I have to tell you that I saw people in the concentration camps pray to God, and we looked for him everywhere and couldn't find him. So we were really disappointed. But we kept asking God, where are you? But as I get older, and soon afterwards, I realized that it's not so much God, where are you, but man. Where was man? There's God in all of us. And how did man allow this to happen? And I remember reading a book, a quote from Albert Einstein, who was a pacifist. And he said, see if I can remember the exact quote, that the world is a dangerous place we live in, not because of evil people, but because there are people that do nothing about it. So, although we gave up on God for a while, what I learned at home served me all my life. I left him for a while, but I came back to him. The resiliency of the human spirit. And to honor my parents and those that perished, I said, I cannot do otherwise. And I do this, and to me, what I'm doing is sacred. And I have a duty and obligation to do it.
My question is, it's all boys. Did the girls all die? Did the girls make it? Were there camps that had girls, or were they killed?
Most of them were. Some of them, my sister, for instance, who was in her teens, she was liberated. She worked in the munitions factory as well, and she was liberated in Bergen-Belsen. And here's a good example. Her kids and her grandkids come to me for information because she cannot talk. And I really had to really force myself to start doing it. She can't do it. And less girls survived. I represent, as you heard, I think it's 7%. And that also represents young children that were hidden. And I must say that I really am so proud of those people that did, risk their own life to hide a Jewish child. And some of them made it. And so in the midst of all these horrors, you know, I can list all kinds of bits of kindness. We don't have that much time, but I have all kinds of tales of people risking their lives and so on.
How many of the boys of Buchenwald are still surviving, and what do those friendships and bonds mean to you?
The friendships that we have mean everything. I saw Abe Chapnick, and he invited me. He lives in New York, and we spoke together to a group of students, and it was very gratifying, as well as my liberator that joined us. On April 11, my phone, I'm busy on the phone almost all day to contact whoever I can and get phone calls, and I phone back and so on from Israel, from France, from Australia, and everywhere. Some of us have already passed on, unfortunately. We're aging, we're getting older. Speaking of that, let me just tell you very quickly, when we made this movie, I was instrumental in going to France to get some of the boys to be interviewed. And one of them showed me a report, because the French government said, look, we don't want to be responsible for these hoodlums because they won't amount to anything. They will never rehabilitate. So they asked some psychiatrists to do a report, and I saw that report. It was lengthy, but two things stood out. One, that I just mentioned, they'll never amount to anything, so better the Jewish organization look after them. Number two, they will not live beyond 40. So last November, I phoned my friend Elie Wiesel to wish him a happy birthday for his 80th and reminded him that we were supposed to be dead at 40. So he said, that was the nicest message I've ever received. And so, and of course, we weren't amount to anything. And of course, you know, Elie Wiesel, a Nobel Peace Prize winner. So again, I guess psychiatry wasn't as advanced as it is now. And they probably didn't recognize the resiliency of the human spirit and what you can achieve. So, which reminds me to all young people here, whatever you set out to do, you can achieve. Trust me.
I was wondering, is there anybody you miss the most from out of everything?
Can you repeat that?
Is there anybody, not your family, friends, people you met at the camps, that you miss the most?
Well, as I was invited to go of the March of the Living, and I have not gone back home, but I have a sort of a pull. I would like to go back. And as I also age, and when I look at my grandchildren, because, you know, I made a life. I married and have a son and daughter. Now I am a proud grandfather of Kira and Ava. And when I look at them, I'm just in seventh heaven, and then I look at the other side and I'm saddened when I think of my little nephew, I think of all my brothers and my parents, and they're gone. And you multiply this 6 million of lives, the pain is stronger than ever before. I miss my family terribly, and it's always going to be there. And I'm just grateful that we had these people in France that showed us how to put this aside. It's always there, but we had to find a way of living every day and create a family, make a life. So it's a very difficult question. I will always miss him till the day I die.
First of all, happy belated birthday. Second of all, if you ever got the chance to go back to the concentration camp, would you?
Yes, I was asked to do it, and I'm just trying to get the courage, because the March of the Living is young people, thousands of them that go back. And so in Canada, they want me to come with this group. And I have turned it down because I didn't think that I would be able to handle it. But I have just a inside sort of a feeling that I have to do it, even no matter how painful it is. I want to go back where I was born, and so more or less that would be the place to acknowledge to my parents, look, I made it. One of your sibling or two of your siblings made it. We have a family, and life is moving on, and you will not be forgotten. And it's that place there that I need to do this. You have fantastic questions there.
Did you ever, talk to that girl that you're going to talk to
I was told that she was there, and I was supposed to go back to see her, and then just didn't happen, so that's something I still need to do. Before I let you go, particularly the young people, I want to end with a word about love. And you're probably thinking, what is he going to tell us about love? I'm not referring the love that if you go into, you have 7-Eleven with magazines and stuff, girlies and boys with muscles. You probably looked at those. I have. Anyway, that's not the kind of love I'm referring to. I want to talk to you about love that your teachers and everyone responsible for bringing you here. They wanted you to be here so that you can be inoculated against hatred and discrimination. And that is love that I cannot find words to describe. And today, you know, after seeing that other little clip which shows you what the Holocaust was all about, it's kind of heavy. And when you go home this afternoon, before you open the door, just think for a moment, what is on the other side of the door? You have sisters and brothers and loving parents. And maybe your little brother or your little sister used your iPod and messed it up. And you're really going to give it to them. You know, trust me, you can replace the iPod, but the love and the care that you have on the other side of that door is very precious. And when I tell you this, I think of what I wouldn't have given to have that one hug with my brother Abram as he was being led away. Don't take it for granted. I wish you all the best. Have a good life. I love you.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Robbie Weissman, a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust. In recognition of Holocaust Remembrance Day, the Durham Museum partnered with the Jewish Federation and the Institute for Holocaust Education for this special presentation. Mr. Weissman's talk followed a special screening of the 2002 Canadian television documentary The Boys of Buchenwald, directed by Audrey Miller, which chronicled the return after nearly 60 years of three child survivors of the Buchenwald concentration camp, including Mr. Weissman, Joseph Schwarzberg, and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Elie Wiesel, to the homes in France which took them in after the war. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, May 4, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The 8 days of the Hanukkah celebration begin at sundown this evening. As we remember the words of hope and rescue of today's speaker, I'd like to take this opportunity to wish everyone a most happy and blessed Hanukkah season. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.